Morning again. Excuse me. So we are continuing to go to follow the lectionary as it makes its way through the book of Romans. And what kind of surprises me about this is that every time I go to that particular reading for the week, so in this case, chapter 7, I always have to go back a couple of chapters. Because Paul is not giving a like systematic, kind of line-by-line, idea-by-idea series of statements that we are then to just like take and apply as though it were just pure logic. The problem is that we tend to read it like that. And in doing so, we kind of miss the fact that Paul is actually telling a story. And he's doing so in a way that would have been obvious to the people who received the letter, but, 2,000 years later, as it turns out, some things have changed. Now, again, just so we're all on the same page, as Paul is writing to the Christians in the city of Rome, he's not giving a, like, play-by-play way to, you know, have your sins forgiven or go to heaven when you die, whatever that would mean, or anything like that. Paul is actually trying to bring back together two groups of people that had been separated for quite some time, really by the Roman emperor. Those groups being the Gentiles, so those not Jewish who come out of the Greco-Roman world, so worshiping the Greco-Roman gods and that sort of thing, although surely some of them were interested in Judaism. And then you have the Jewish people who had been removed from Rome and then allowed back. And because those groups are so different, and because if you have a Jewish background in this era, you are far more versed in the scriptures and the story of God than your Gentile friends, really the Gentiles actually need you to help explain the scriptures and to just explain what this whole Jesus thing is. I mean, if you went to like a random Gentile in the city of Corinth and said, Jesus, the Messiah, the Holy Anointed One, Son of David, has died for your sins and raised from the dead, they would literally understand like four words in that sentence. And so, because the Jewish people had been removed from Rome, the Gentiles had to learn to stand on their own feet, now we have a problem. It's just like the perfect storm for conflict. So as Paul is going through and leading up to really Romans chapter 8 is kind of the first like climactic moment in his letter to the Romans, he is explaining that everybody, regardless of your background, stands before God on the same footing. In other words, not much. And he is also retelling the story of God as God originally had made his promise to Abraham that his descendants would be like the stars in the sky and so on and so forth, and that through his line, all of the nations will be blessed. And even though his descendants were decidedly unfaithful, God has always been faithful. And now they have the privilege of living at a time when God revealed his final plan. Now, that takes us roughly to chapter 5-ish, and then into chapter 6, Paul explains that we all come together because we share baptism. And baptism isn't just a symbol. It's not a thing you just do because you might as well find something to do, or you smell, so you need a bath, or something like that. All right. But rather, he says, no, in baptism, you die with Jesus. You are buried with him. But Jesus didn't stay dead. And if you're buried with Jesus in baptism, then in baptism, you are raised with him as well. So death doesn't have a claim over you anymore, that final evil enemy. Now, that's chapter 6. Now, we get into chapter 7, and Paul, he talks about himself. And if you notice at the beginning, I think it's verse 1, he specifically says, brothers. And we've got to figure out which brothers does he mean. As far as we know, he doesn't have siblings. He might have. But he's actually talking to his fellow Jewish people. Why? Because they're the ones that have the law. Torah. They've had the scriptures. And in fact, if you are at all taking this, what it means to be Jewish seriously in the first century, then there's a decent chance that you have a huge chunk of the Hebrew Bible memorized. And so because they have the Torah, God's gift, his teachings, it's also translated his law, that creates some other issues. Now, first and foremost, it is often traditionally talked about, or this passage anyway, is understood as a fight against legalism. Legalism is sticking to the letter of the law as strictly as you possibly can because you think that it will in some way justify you. And we all have tendencies to be like this. This isn't just for the rule followers. This is as much for the rule breakers as well, because if you're more of a rule breaker, you like to push the boundaries, then you feel like you always have to. Like that's your identity, and then that's the same problem. But Paul is actually talking first and foremost to his own people, and he's telling the story, believe it or not, of the Exodus. Think about the way he describes sin. He mentions like coveting as an example, but he's not interested or less interested in delineating or coming up with whatever the first century equivalent of a bullet point list is of sins you should avoid. I mean, we could do that. We could have, like, we could all have a big congregational meeting and get a really big piece of paper out and just start writing things that we won't do. But the problem is that will change nothing about our hearts. If we're lucky, it might change our behavior sometimes. But it will miss the point. As Paul is explaining this whole idea of the law and the sin and how those two concepts are, they seem opposite, but they also seem related and they seem intertwined, and sin uses the law, and it's deeply confusing. But the place to start is that he describes sin as almost a force. Not like in the Star Wars sense, but like this, it takes on a personality. To put it another way, if you look at the sum total of evil that human beings are capable of, in a weird way, that sum total is greater than the individual acts of evil that we commit. In other words, it has a personality. He talks about it almost as if it has an intention. It means to be the way it is. And personally to me, I find this very, very intuitive. It makes sense to me. I mean, if you look at the world around you as it continues to feel like it's on fire, except for everybody who's having a ton of fun being part of the World Cup and traveling from city to city, otherwise, it seems like the world is just absolutely on fire. It's easier to believe in a personal spiritual evil force sometimes than it is the opposite. Because how much of our experience does it feel like sometimes evil continues to win? That's what Paul is talking about. But we can take this even deeper. Because as he's writing to specifically his Jewish contingency, which is his own people, he's explaining that one of the things that happened when God gave their people Torah or the law is it revealed their own inadequacy. It created this measure or this standard by which we can compare ourselves. And I don't know about you, but if you take the expectations that God has for you, or to put it another way, what it means to be human in the best, truest sense of the word, and then you look at yourself, you inevitably will not measure up. And just by sheer warning, if you look at those standards and you feel like you do, oh, danger. That's not good at all. And the law, as a result, it becomes this mirror. And actually, that's an idea that Martin Luther would use, that it shows you who you really are. And maybe I'm alone in this. I highly suspect that I'm not. Those times in my life when I am shown by my actions and the consequences of my actions who I really am, not a fan. Not a fan at all. It's like being in a maybe a conflict situation or something like that, and you have that startling, frustrating moment where you realize, I'm the bad guy here, aren't I? Uh-oh. What do we do now? But the law has other ways that it has functioned, even though it all kind of leads to the same place. As Paul uses the example of coveting, you wouldn't know what that means unless somebody said, don't covet, which that was Moses speaking for God, by the way. Because how many of us are not aware that some of the things that we do or the things in our hearts, the way that we act, the way that we've been conditioned to be in the world is in fact really destructive. And we had no idea until it was pointed out to us. Give you a wild example from the 1800s, because why not? In the Victorian era, it was, as it turns out, an era that is kind of marked by high society and everything in its place, everybody in their place, which is not good. As it turns out, in that structured, highly ordered society, children are hard to deal with. I don't know if you've noticed that. It was true back then, too. And it became alarmingly common to give kids laudanum, something called laudanum, to sort of calm them down. Laudanum is just another word for opium, by the way. It's not good. But as it turns out, the kids behaved. And it caused so many problems, scary problems. And it wasn't until researchers, people, whatever, noticed the problems that it was causing that they said, whoa, wait a minute, we need to put some laws in place because this is actually really, really bad. And you had all of these people going, oh my gosh, we had no idea. The law can function like that. Now, is that a bad thing? No, it really isn't. Is it comfortable? No, not even close. But here's the other problem. If it shows you the issue, it doesn't give you a way out. There's no way to fix it. Like, at least in modern society, when I'm speeding down Wyoming, and I don't know if there was like a cop who was bored, like the one cop who had nothing to do in Albuquerque, he pulls me over, and I get a speeding ticket. Which, this is hypothetical, this didn't happen yet. But there's a way out. You pay your fine, you do, you know, whatever you have to do, and then it's over. The problem is that in this grand story where God creates a family for himself who has the privilege to be the caretakers of his presence, they're the ones who represent what it means to follow God to the rest of the world. They are literally priests to the nations, and they've been given the gift of Torah. The problem is that there's no resolution ultimately. Like, yeah, if you mess up, you can go to the temple, you can do the sacrifices, say certain prayers, and there are certain rituals, and you can wash, and so on and so forth. And that's all well and good. But as Paul is starting to unveil and open up this bigger story that God is telling, one of the features is that the law that God has placed before people is not the point. It is merely a signpost along the way. Now, that signpost is very important. Signs tend to be important. They show you where to go. They also show you where not to go, and they show you how to get there. So when God says, don't murder, like, this is a good thing, don't murder. Okay, but what else? Because I've never murdered anybody, so does that not apply? No. What about the opposite? Have you actually tried to engage and seek for the thriving of human life everywhere you go? Not necessarily. Should I? You bet. But as Paul is telling this story, he's describing sin in relation to this law, which doesn't have a resolution yet, as this force that enslaves. And here's where the Gentiles get pulled back in, because whether they understand it or not, they're held captive. And sin has this tendency to just grab us and hold us. It's kind of like our phones. Put down your phone for a day, I dare you. Yeah, can you? Technically, yes, but I don't want to. I can quit any time. And in fact, a couple of weeks ago on our retreat at the end of May, the service was so bad out there that I just left my phone, and it was really alarming how many times I reached for my pocket. Sin becomes this enslaver. And if you insist that no, you're free, you can make your own choices, you're not captured by anything, great, take one of those things, anything, and just stop. Can you? Maybe for an hour. But given a long enough timeline, we'll start to realize that maybe we're actually held down, that the ground pulls at our feet. And it is to that enslaving to sin that Paul is building, really, like it comes to a head in chapter 8, so we're going to look ahead a little bit. That the point for Jesus as he enters into creation, as he lives and exists under the law, he managed to follow God's expectations and law perfectly. He was, in essence, a truly human being in the best sense of the word for the first time. And then through his death, as we die with him, and then through his resurrection, which we are promised we will be raised with him, what we get to see, what we have the privilege to see, is that what God has been planning this whole time is finally to be set free from the sin, the darkness, and the evil within our own hearts. Notice, however, what I have not said. And I'm not saying it because Paul has not said it. This has nothing to do with our behavior. Because imagine again that we as a community wrote out all of these things that we're not going to do, that we don't do here because they violate God's expectations of ourselves. We're not going to be able to keep that. It's a nice idea. Honestly, it would get pretty old pretty fast. And all of that would be irrelevant because Jesus already fulfilled and finished the law. And it has nothing to do with our ability to live up to any standards, even our own standards, let alone God's. It's very easy in these conversations to fall on one or the other side. One of those sides is, well, Paul says I don't have to do any of this, so I'm not going to. And that would violate what it means to be human. And on the other hand, we can feel so encumbered and so we can desire or want for ourselves so badly to be free from sin that we will take matters into our own hands and say and become the legalist, the thing that especially Lutherans kind of break out in hives towards. Because we insist correctly that God saves us apart from anything that we can do or offer to Him, because it's Jesus who did it for us. But the temptation is always to go back to justifying ourselves, to convince ourselves that we are not okay. Now, all of that is a long, complicated summary of one of the most consequential and frankly complicated letters ever written. But to summarize, it would be this. God placed standards and expectations before us, before all of humanity. And it was His chosen people, the Jewish people, or Israel, that had the privilege to bear those expectations to the rest of the world. They failed. And in fact, human failure is one consistent thing about the whole story of God. But but those laws were never the point. They were always intended to point us to something else, to point us ahead to when God, rather than insisting that we save ourselves, insisting that we pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps, insist that we measure up to our own standards, the standards that everybody around us sets for us, the expectations that our government, our community, our family, our teachers, or whomever might set for us, that apart from all of that, God has stepped in Jesus and fulfilled all of that for all time for us. It cost Jesus His life, which means we ourselves are extraordinarily valuable. And to insist that we have anything to offer God to be a part of this story makes zero sense. Because God has already drowned us in the waters of baptism. He has already raised us in new life. And anything that suggests otherwise is a lie. So as we are making our way to Romans chapter 8, which is like one of the best chapters in the entire Bible, we are now at this point where not only are we unable to stand before God because of our imperfection, the dehumanization that we have all taken part of, and through the law, through the long history that God has told through His people, we are now set free from that enslaving force that the Bible calls sin. And it has nothing to do with our ability or inability to live up to God's standards. Because in Jesus, we have already been declared not guilty. The sentence has been commuted. Use whatever metaphor you want. None of that has a hold on us anymore. Because Jesus accomplished all of it. Amen. Please rise as you are able.